Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the Soviet Union end, and how did the ambitions, ideologies, and rivalries of the leaders involved play into the way it came apart? It has been 20 years since Mikhail Gorbachev signed his own resignation on Christmas Day, ending the vast communist union with a whimper rather than a bang. But as historic as the day was, its actual events were witnessed by only a small number of people, mostly Western journalists, as newly independent Russians and their counterparts in the other republics struggled with mixed feelings about Gorbachev and his legacy. Journalist and author Conor O'Cleary is a former Moscow bureau chief for the Irish Times. He tells the story in his new book, Moscow, December 25th, 1991, The Last Day of the Soviet Union. Conor, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris.
So much has been written over the past 20 years about the months and years leading up to the breakup of the Soviet Union, as well as what followed. Why have we not heard so much about the very last day?
Well, I think possibly that's because of the coup, the attempted coup, which took place by Soviet hardliners in August of that year, which heralded to many people the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union. And people tend to remember the coup rather than the actual last day of the Soviet Union. I think that's probably the reason.
And talk about this. Mikhail Gorbachev was nothing if not a proponent of communist ideology, but he did recognize the need for reforms. What was his vision of what the Soviet Union could be with the changes he wanted to put in place?
Well, Mikhail Gorbachev became General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in 1985, and in effect that meant he was like a czar. He was the head of a small group of people that ran the Soviet Union, dictated everything from the price of a loaf of bread to whether or not a person would go to prison. He, however, saw, and in his own words on that day, speaking to his wife Reza in private, that everything was rotten in the Soviet Union. The economy was not working. They were engaged in a very expensive Cold War with the United States. And he decided that he needed a program of reform, not to break up the Soviet Union, not to bring it to an end, but to improve it. And he called this process perestroika. And he also introduced a parallel process of openness and transparency called glasnost to allow people in the Soviet Union to debate the best way forward. But he never intended that the Soviet Union should break up. He simply wanted to reform it.
Why was he the one chosen as General Secretary in 1985 after the death of Chernenko?
Well, at that time, there had been what was called a period of stagnation in the Soviet Union, and the leadership had become very old. And Gorbachev had been seen by these old men in the leadership as someone who was a true communist, who had bright ideas, who was seen by people abroad. Margaret Thatcher, for example, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, saw him as a person she could do business with, seen by somebody who would be acceptable internationally. And they decided that he was the person who would bring in these necessary reforms to improve the Soviet economy and prevent a wave of discontent that was slowly building up in the Soviet Union and could lead, as his secretary indeed warned him at that time, to an explosion one day.
And in the beginning, a key member of Gorbachev's team was Boris Yeltsin, who he selected as the first secretary of the Communist Party in Moscow. What sort of relationship did the two have politically and personally in the early days, in 1985?
Well, Gorbachev decided to put together a new team. He got rid of some of the old guard, including the leader of the Moscow City Communist Party, who had been presiding over a very corrupt and inefficient regime. He selected Boris Yeltsin, who was the Communist Party leader in Sverdlovsk, because Yeltsin was seen as a bit of a rough diamond who was prepared to bring in his own form of reforms as effectively as anybody in the leadership of the Communist Party could. He was known as a stormer, somebody who would work really hard to get changes made and to get things done, and who would think nothing of firing people who were inefficient and corrupt. So even though Gorbachev didn't like Yeltsin personally very much, he saw him as rather impetuous and hard-drinking and a backwoods man, really, where Gorbachev himself was rather urbane and sophisticated as Communist Party leaders go. But he decided he was the best person to shake Moscow up, and that's how he included Yeltsin in his team and made him a candidate member of the Politburo, the small number of Communist Party leaders surrounding Gorbachev who ran the Soviet Union.
Connor, we're going to pause here. You sound great, but on our end, on my end of the phone line, we're getting an echo, so we're going to hang up and call you right back if you would stick with us. My guest this hour is Connor O'Cleary. He is a journalist and author. He was former Moscow bureau chief for the Irish Times and was living in Moscow around the time of the breakup of the Soviet Union. We're talking this hour about his new book, Moscow, December 25th, 1991, the last day of the Soviet Union. As always, if you would like to participate in the conversation, you can send us an email. The address is think@kera.org. You can also get to us on the phone lines at 1-800-933-5372. We are reestablishing this connection with you for you right now with Connor O'Cleary so we can continue our discussion of his book. Connor, thank you so much for your patience. Are you back with us?
Yes, I'm back with you, Chris.
Everything sounds better. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeltsin was initially supportive of Gorbachev's ideas for reform, although they were very different men in many ways, as you've mentioned. Talk a little bit about how their temperaments and their public personas read to average Soviets and how people saw the two of them as leaders.
Well, interestingly, Gorbachev was very popular at the beginning. The Soviet people saw him as somebody who might bring change to their lives, and they were having a pretty tough time getting by every day. There were queues in the shops, and there were shortages. But Yeltsin was a bit more open about what was wrong with the Soviet Union, and he stirred things up at a meeting of the Central Committee. That's the 200 or 300 lower leadership level in the Soviet Union. By openly criticizing the benefits that the communist leaders gave themselves with special shops and special hospitals and medical service and cars and sumptuous dachas outside Moscow. And this caused a bit of a stir with not just within the Communist Party ranks, but in Moscow itself, where there was a lot of unhappiness about the poor standard of living that many people had to put up with. Now, Gorbachev tolerated this, but his personality and Yeltsin's grated with each other because Gorbachev wanted things to proceed smoothly without disturbing too many of the hardliners in the party who he thought might resist his reforms, whereas here was Yeltsin sort of prepared to stir things up and publicly criticized Gorbachev himself for moving too slowly and for allowing these benefits for Communist Party leaders to continue while people were suffering.
So ultimately, Yeltsin says, that's it, I cannot support this administration anymore, and he resigns from the Politburo.
Yes, he did. After a couple of years in power, he decided he would resign. Gorbachev was giving him the cold shoulder. He felt he wasn't being able to get things done in Moscow the way he wanted, and he resigned. Now, this led to a rather tempestuous meeting of the top leadership of the Communist Party, at which Gorbachev humiliated Boris Yeltsin. And Boris Yeltsin took this so badly that he claims that he tried to commit suicide, though Gorbachev doubts that this was nothing but trying to draw attention to himself. However, Yeltsin did end up in hospital, and Gorbachev then held a second meeting to have him dismissed as leader of the Moscow Communist Party, and that he had him drugged and brought from hospital to be humiliated for a period of about 2 to 3 hours by top members of the Communist Party who accused him of all sorts of misdemeanors and crimes against communism. And Yeltsin never forgave Gorbachev for this, and it led the groundwork for what was to come in the following couple of years leading to the end of the Soviet Union, where the political dynamism in the Soviet Union was determined very much by the the hatred that Gorbachev and Yeltsin had developed for each other by this stage.
So let's talk about some of the specific reforms that Gorbachev had proposed. He had already made it clear that he would not, for example, interfere with the knocking down of the Berlin Wall. He would not send Soviet troops in to prop up regional governments that were abusing their own people. And he said that he would allow each republic to elect its own regional leader.
Well, I think Gorbachev must always be remembered as the person who ended the Cold War. He made it clear to the Eastern European countries that were held in thrall to the Kremlin since the Second World War that he would no longer, could no longer fear that Soviet tanks would stop reforms in those countries. And of course, this was a signal for them to break the connection with the Soviet Union. He also withdrew Soviet troops from Afghanistan, where they were fighting a losing war. He, moreover, declared that he would move the Soviet Union to a market economy. However, and here again the clash with Gorbachev became accentuated, his version of a move to a market economy was very much a slow process which would only make things worse in the eyes of some of the top reformers in the Soviet Union, whereas Yeltsin's idea was to make a quick dash to a market economy. And when they disagreed over this, the suppliers throughout the Soviet Union began to hold on to whatever goods they had, and this led to even greater shortages.
Was he aware that Boris Yeltsin, there was a chance that Boris Yeltsin would be chosen president of Russia?
Well, one of the reforms, there were two major reforms in electoral terms that Gorbachev brought in. One was an election to a Congress of People's Deputies from all over the Soviet Union, which was a free and fair election, even though the Communist Party decided they would hold on to a certain proportion of the seats by right. But it was a free and fair election, and Gorbachev was unable to prevent Yeltsin being elected a member of Congress by, he got something like 90% of the vote in Moscow City. Then he allowed every republic to have an election to its own parliament. Now, in those days, there were 15 republics making up the Soviet Union. Each had a parliament which was nominally elected, but before then they had always been fixed by the Communist Party, and they had very little power. Gorbachev thought that if he allowed the republics to elect their own leaders and their own parliaments in fair elections, that they could then try and cope with their economic distress on an individual basis. He called it self-financing, this process that he wanted them to bring in. But of course, the dynamic that arose from that was that people like Yeltsin were elected president of Russia, and other nationalist-minded leaders were elected in the republics. And this set in train the process which inevitably would lead to these republics looking to break away from the Soviet Union.
My guest is journalist Conor O'Cleary. We're talking about his new book, Moscow, December 25th, 1991, The Last Day of the Soviet Union. We should talk about the fact that Gorbachev was very early on very much liked by important Western leaders, including those of Great Britain and the United States.
Gorbachev began to, if one considers that Soviet leaders before Gorbachev had always adopted a rather hostile attitude to the West, and they were conducting an ideological Cold War right up to the time that Gorbachev became president. He emerged in the eyes of world leaders as someone, to quote Margaret Thatcher again, they could do business with, as someone who is prepared to withdraw Soviet troops from Eastern Europe, as someone who is prepared to sit down with Ronald Reagan, as he did in Reykjavik, the capital of Iceland, in the first summit they held together, to discuss ways of ending the nuclear arms race. And for that reason, and because Gorbachev was seen as the person who was instrumental in bringing about an end to the Cold War.
Sorry, let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Conor O'Cleary. You can join the conversation in a moment by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist and author Conor O'Cleary. He's former Moscow bureau chief for the Irish Times and author of the new book Moscow, December 25th, 1991, The Last Day of the Soviet Union. If you'd like to join the conversation, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Conor, when we were interrupted by the break, you were talking about the relationship between Gorbachev and Western leaders, and specifically, I think you were speaking about the discussions about nuclear disarmament that Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan had.
That's correct. One of the reasons that Gorbachev was so attractive to Western leaders was because he initiated very serious talks about reducing the nuclear arsenals of both the West and of the Soviet Union. He had a very practical reason for doing this because of the Star Wars initiative introduced by President Reagan. The Soviet Union faced a very expensive process of trying to match this, and they simply couldn't afford it. So Yeltsin, or Mikhail Gorbachev, was being very practical, but at the same time he was offering the world a better future, in that the danger of nuclear war would recede, and indeed the Doomsday Clock, which looks at how close the world is to atomic war, was put back in those days by 7 minutes because of the world could see that the danger of nuclear war was receding.
What kind of pushback was Gorbachev getting from hardliners within his own party?
I beg your pardon?
What sort of pushback was there from hardliners within the Communist Party to Gorbachev's attempts to make peace?
What Gorbachev was doing threatened the privileged position of the leaders of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. And many of the hardliners, like Vladimir Kruchkov, the head of the KGB, and Dmitry Yazov, the head of the army, they saw the process that Gorbachev was conducting and the series of reforms as leading inevitably to the breakup of the Soviet Union, particularly the granting of greater freedoms and autonomy to the 15 republics of the Soviet Union. And the pushback began in earnest in 1990 when the hardliners began to conspire against Gorbachev. Now, he has always been criticized for not getting rid of them, but he has argued since the fall of the Soviet Union that he couldn't, because he had to keep them close, keep his enemies close within the party, otherwise they would stage a coup. And of course they did attempt to stage a coup in August of 1991, which failed because by that stage the Soviet people weren't prepared to endure the return to totalitarianism, and the Soviet army was not prepared to fire on the people.
Did Gorbachev realize before that point that the end of the Soviet Union was coming one way or another?
Gorbachev didn't accept that the end of the Soviet Union was coming until, in reality, a few days before it ended on December 25th, 1991. He tried everything he could to prevent it coming to an end, and he tolerated some rather repressive measures by his hardline military leaders in the Baltics in early 1991, when he was tempted with the idea of stopping nationalism in its tracks in the republics. But he very quickly backed away from that, especially after 13 people were killed in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, when they declared independence their intention to become independent from the Soviet Union. One thing that I think Gorbachev has to be credited with is that he didn't want bloodshed. And of course, with these two things together, the fact that he wasn't prepared to use tanks in Eastern Europe and the fact that he wasn't prepared to use tanks against his own people, inevitably meant that the climate of fear had gone in the Soviet Union, and that meant the Soviet Union could not be held together anymore, because that's what held it together.
And tell us a little bit about that burgeoning nationalism in the other republics outside of Russia itself. I mean, had these places always maintained a sense of unity with those around them within the republic, as opposed to feeling like Soviet citizens?
Well, if you take the three Baltic republics of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and I believe, having been there at the time, that this is where the Soviet Union really began to unravel, because they took the idea of having their own parliaments, with Gorbachev's blessing, as the first step towards independence. These three republics had been independent between the wars, but they had been annexed by the Soviet Union at the time of the Second World War. Anybody who visited those republics in Soviet days would realize very quickly that the people there never accepted that they were the Kremlin had any right to control these republics, and they always wanted their independence back. Once they started to declare their aim of independence, the other republics began to sit up and take notice, and the latent nationalism that existed in Ukraine and in places like republics like Georgia and Armenia began to find expression. They found expression through what became known as popular fronts, where intellectuals and Communist Party leaders and national leaders got together to decide how best to work out their own reforms. And, of course, that inevitably led to the question of should they not be independent.
What sort of relationship was Boris Yeltsin as the new president of Russia before the breakup of the Soviet Union? What sort of relationship was he building with the leaders of the other republics?
Yeltsin, it's very interesting that because Yeltsin himself began to talk about the possibility of Russia leaving the Soviet Union, this emboldened the other leaders of the republics to think in those terms. I mean, if the most popular Russian was encouraging them to think in those terms, well, obviously they were going to do so. His relationship with the other Republican leaders was very much one of let's all get together and see if we can get rid of this guy in the Kremlin. They didn't like, none of them liked Mikhail Gorbachev very much. And they started a process with Gorbachev of discussing a new type of Soviet Union. And this process began just before the attempted coup and continued afterwards. But as it went along, several leaders of the republics dropped out, and Boris Yeltsin and the leaders of two other republics decided that they would simply break away and break up the Soviet Union themselves. And indeed, 20 years ago, on this very day, December 7th, Yeltsin met the leader of Ukraine, who's President Kravchuk, and Shushkevich, the leader of Belarus, in a dacha in a forest near the Polish border. And there they decided that as these three republics had together formed the Soviet Union 70 years earlier, they would simply now collapse it from within and disband it. And once they made that decision, there was no going back. And 3 weeks later, less than 3 weeks later, the Soviet Union was at an end.
Was there anything before that time that Gorbachev could have done to hold things together, or was it effectively over no matter what he did?
Well, Gorbachev wanted to maintain the Soviet Union in some form. In the discussions with the leaders of the other republics, he gave more and more ground in a desperate attempt to prevent nationalism winning the day and the republics becoming independent. He was even prepared to allow them to have their own armed forces, to allow them to conduct their own foreign affairs. But the one thing that he conceded, and he conceded this even before the coup, was that they could raise their own taxes without the Kremlin having any right to tax the republics in turn. And this, according to Igor Gaidar, who was Yeltsin's first prime minister, whom I interviewed in Moscow for this book, he said that to him that was the end of the Soviet Union. Once Gorbachev agreed to that, it didn't matter what form the relationship with the republics would take, that was the end of the Soviet Union.
Did the United States and Great Britain do anything to aid the staying together of the Soviet Union, given that they were concerned about the stability of these breakaway republics and what might happen once what had been our greatest dream actually came true?
It's one of the ironies of history that the West, the leaders in the West, and Germany and Great Britain and President George H.W. Bush in the United States tried to help Gorbachev keep the Soviet Union together. They were, of course, very worried about 15 republics, four of which had nuclear weapons, breaking away and with the possibility of chaos and anarchy. And indeed, just before the coup in August of 1991, when President George H.W. Bush visited Moscow, Gorbachev asked him, when he was going to the Ukraine the next day, he asked President Bush to try and persuade the Ukrainians not to break away from the Soviet Union. Gorbachev couldn't believe that the Ukraine would break away from Russia because of the ethnic closeness of the Ukrainians and the Russians. And indeed, President Bush, when he went to Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, he made a speech in which he advised the Ukrainians not to follow the nationalist path, and for which many Ukrainians never forgave him. But it was all to no avail because the Ukrainians had by this stage more or less decided they were going to take the road to independence. And indeed, in a referendum on December 1st of 1991, 3 weeks before the breakup of the Soviet Union, they decided by a huge majority to break away and declare independence.
Connor, tell us a little bit about the days and hours leading up to that signing of the document that essentially by which Gorbachev resigned and the Soviet Union ended on Christmas Day. What sort of talks were taking place right before then?
Well, the 20 years ago today, as I mentioned, the three leaders of Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus got together and decided that they would collapse the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. They had to recruit the leaders of the other republics, and they successfully did so, and they met in Alma-Ata 4 days before the end of the Soviet Union and agreed to form what became known as the Commonwealth of Independent States. Now, this was a fig leaf to cover the divorce, if you like. Mm. Up to that point, Mikhail Gorbachev still believed that the process could be reversed in some way and that the Soviet Union would still hold together and that he could still stay in the Kremlin as the titular leader, almost like the Queen of England, of a Soviet Union that was held together more loosely than before. But Yeltsin decided that this wasn't good enough. He wanted Gorbachev out of the Kremlin so he could move in himself. And 2 days before the end, 2 days after the meeting in Alma-Ata, he simply walked into the Kremlin in the morning and said to Gorbachev, "I want to settle this all now." Hmm. And for 9 hours, they met in a room that's known as the Walnut Room in the Kremlin, and consuming several glasses of vodka and brandy, they decided on how the breakup would take place. Yeltsin promised Gorbachev he could stay for 3 days after he resigned on the 25th. He could stay for three more days in the Kremlin, that he could stay for another few days in his presidential dacha outside Moscow, and that the Soviet Union would, in effect, come to an end on the 31st of December, and then the red flag would come down. Now, Yeltsin didn't keep many of these promises, as I explained in the book, he couldn't resist the opportunity to engage in some malevolent behavior towards Gorbachev because of Gorbachev's treatment of him in earlier years.
There was the treatment of him in earlier years, and there were also the final remarks that Gorbachev made that really incensed Yeltsin. What did he say and not say that made Boris Yeltsin so angry?
Well, I think you're referring to Yeltsin or Gorbachev's resignation speech.
Yes.
The last day, the 25th, was choreographed by Gorbachev and Yeltsin. It was agreed that Gorbachev would make a resignation speech at 7 o'clock that evening. And Yeltsin, of course, would subsequently move into the Kremlin. After the speech, there was to take place a very important symbolic act, and that was the passing from Gorbachev to Yeltsin of the nuclear suitcase. Now, the nuclear suitcase was the suitcase that contained the ability for the leader of the Soviet Union, as it still was, to contact strategic reaction center in Moscow in the event of a nuclear war. And as long as Gorbachev had that nuclear suitcase in his possession, then the Soviet Union still existed, if you like. Mm-hmm. After his resignation speech, he was to hand this nuclear suitcase to Yeltsin in his office. However, during his speech, Gorbachev refused to wish Yeltsin well. He declined to give Yeltsin any credit for the process in the Soviet Union that had led to some of the reforms. And Yeltsin, when he began to listen to the speech in an office nearby or watching it on television, he grew very incensed, and in a bit of a tantrum, he said, I'm going to collect the nuclear suitcase. Gorbachev can bring it to me. And there was a lot of backwards and forwards negotiations between Gorbachev and Yeltsin's people before the generals agreed to step in and effect the transfer of the nuclear suitcase without the two men meeting. And in fact, they never met again after that day. And the only people to witness the transfer of the nuclear suitcase, this very important and symbolic act, which was supposed to be televised, were the CNN crew who'd been broadcasting Gorbachev's speech from the Kremlin, and who were all packed up and were leaving and were walking down a corridor in the Kremlin when they saw a door opening and generals coming out one side and another door opening, another set of generals appearing, and the nuclear suitcase passing between them. So this historic act was only witnessed by a handful of Americans in a corridor in the Kremlin.
My guest is journalist and author Conor O'Cleary. He's former Moscow bureau chief for the Irish Times and author of the new book Moscow, December 25th, 1991, The Last Day of the Soviet Union. We will take your calls after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Conor O'Cleary, former Moscow bureau chief for the Irish Times and author of the new book Moscow, December 25th, 1991, The Last Day of the Soviet Union. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Bert on the line in Dallas. Hello, Bert.
Hi. I don't want to jump ahead of your story and your timeline, but I've seen some really interesting stuff about Putin and his rise to power. You know, he's kind of portrayed as really Machiavellian, you know, and that he was a sponsor of Yeltsin's rise to power. And then when he succeeded Yeltsin, there's even a lot of people that say that he was conducted this false flag bombing in Moscow to create the impetus to go back into Chechnya. Could you, if you don't want to get into all that, at least tell us what role Putin played in the rise of Yeltsin and that history.
Thanks for your call.
Well, Putin was a member of the KGB at the time of the end of the Soviet Union. And in fact, he was one of the people who was active in opposing the coup by hardliners. He didn't come to prominence until the late 1990s, when President Boris Yeltsin, who had been re-elected president of Russia in 1996, decided in 1999 that he would step down. And he had, by this stage, plucked Putin from relative obscurity, made him head of the successor of the KGB for a while, and then prime minister. And in 1999, on December 31st, he handed over power to Putin as interim president, and he himself stood down. So it was Boris Yeltsin who created Putin, if you like, and Putin, of course, was re-elected for a second term in 2004, and in 2008 handed over to his prime minister, Medvedev. And, of course, in 2012, there'll be another presidential election, and under the Russian constitution, you cannot serve more than two terms consecutively, but you can run again. So Mr. Putin hopes to be re-elected in March next year.
And many people believe that he has been effectively running the country despite Medvedev's having the title all this time.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And one of the interesting things about Putin is that he now regards the breakup of the Soviet Union as, in his own words, one of the greatest geopolitical disasters of the 20th century. Mm. And he has, in an attempt to bring stability back to the Soviet Union, which was pretty much in turmoil after it collapsed, or to bring stability back to Russia, where there's some nostalgia for the Soviet Union, he allowed the red flag to be brought back. It had come down on December 25th, 1991, and replaced with the Russian flag. But he allowed the Russian army to use the red flag again. He brought back the former leader of the KGB, or the founder of the KGB. He allowed a statue to be re-erected in the KGB headquarters in Moscow. And he did other things like that to try and move away from the embarrassment and the humiliation of the collapse of the Soviet Union, which many people in Russia today see with regret, because it was the end of their place in the world as one of the two superpowers. So that has given him a certain amount of popularity. But I think what's happening today is that a lot of people feel that they're being manipulated by his 1-2 act with Medvedev, and that the vote this Sunday for the new Russian parliament has been manipulated.
So there is perhaps some nostalgia for the Soviet Union within Russia. Is there any in the other republics?
There might be in Belarus, which is the closest republic to was the closest republic in spirit to the old Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And indeed, Lukashenko, the dictatorial leader of Belarus, runs the country as if it was still part of the Soviet Union. In fact, if you want to know what the Soviet Union was like, you could do worse than to go to Belarus. The other republics have no nostalgia for the Soviet Union. There's no question of any of them seeking to return, though they might go along with the idea of closer economic ties. And there is a constant debate in Ukraine, for example, as to whether or not they should play a role in the Commonwealth of Independent States with closer economic ties with Russia. But no nostalgia, and certainly not in the Baltic countries. Among the ethnic Baltic people, there's absolutely no nostalgia for the Soviet Union.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to David in Plano. Hi, David.
Hi, Chris. Great show as always.
Thank you.
My question has to do with, because I think there was something at the beginning of the hour, actually, about Gorbachev saying that the most recent election was probably fraudulent and needs to be done again. And I'm kind of curious to know, given the fact that he made that announcement, what kind of pull does Gorbachev still have politically in a country that, or in a country that formed after he allowed the Soviet, or I guess helped the Soviet Union dissolve? I always feel like he's the man who gave an inch and his people took a mile, but at the same, because I'm sure he never expected this to happen when he took power years ago in the 80s. But at the same time, I'm kind of curious to know, does he still have any weight, politically speaking, in his country?
Well, David, Gorbachev is a celebrity outside Russia, but not inside Russia. He's regarded as the person who presided over a period when Russians suffered greater hardships than ever before since the Second World War. He stood for election in 1996 as president against Boris Yeltsin. He only got half of 1% of the vote. Today he's seen as the head of the Gorbachev Foundation. He doesn't get much coverage in the press. And people in the West tend to pay more attention to what he's saying than people in the Soviet Union or the former Soviet Union itself.
Does he live in Moscow?
He lives in Moscow. His foundation has got a lot of the archives of his time in power, and he's constantly there. And when he's not there, he's accepting invitations to other parts of the world. For example, in London, on his 80th birthday earlier this year, he was given a huge reception in the Albert Hall, but his 80th birthday passed practically unnoticed in Russia itself.
Why, in Western conventional wisdom, not for people such as yourself, obviously, who've studied this more carefully, but why does Yeltsin get so little credit among people who have followed this from outside the country?
I think that's because of Yeltsin's image as an impetuous, hard-drinking, backwards man, and a bit of an opportunist. Interestingly, Yeltsin did more to break up the Soviet Union than anybody else and to bring in a market economy at the time, on the very day of the 25th of December 1991, that the Soviet Union was coming to an end. His people were talking to IMF officials in Moscow as to how they would raise prices and bring in privatization. Now, interestingly, Yeltsin's conversion from communist to capitalist was brought about by a visit to the United States in 1989, in which he, in his own memoirs, he recounts how his eyes were opened by visiting Randall's grocery store in Houston, Texas, where he couldn't believe his eyes. He thought that the American hosts of his first trip to the West, were putting wool over his eyes and showing him shops and buildings that were specially for his benefit. Mm. And he couldn't believe what the cornucopia of goods that he saw in Randall's grocery store. And afterwards, he told his sidekick, Lev Sukhanov, he said, "I know now why we had an iron curtain. It was to keep people like us in Russia knowing how good life was outside of the Soviet Union." Mm.
Talk about where you see Russia today, the progress that it's made, and as well as the other republics, and the things that really haven't come to fruition that many people dreamed about.
Well, first of all, I would say that things are better for a lot of people in Russia, and there is a growing middle class. I visited the Siberian city of Krasnoyarsk last October, and my first visit there was 20 years ago, and it was a very downtrodden Soviet provincial city. Now it's got shopping malls, the like of which you would see anywhere in the United States. You have kids on their mobile phones, on their iPads. You have the city has been beautified, and there are designer stores on the main street. So Russia has been transformed. It is now like any other European country. But the gap between the rich and the poor is growing all the time, and the economy, which has been largely built on the oil sales that Russia has benefited from, the high price of oil, is not developing in a way that would guarantee that its future prosperity would be guaranteed. And I think that's one of the reasons for the discontent on the streets of Moscow.
Is there a lot of outward migration to other countries?
Well, a lot of the rich Russians are migrating. The oligarchs like to buy yachts and live on the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. Some of them have migrated to London for different reasons. So many Russians send their children now to English public schools. A Russian oligarch called Berezovsky has bought a football club, Chelsea Football Club in London, and bought a couple of newspapers. So Russians have become like any other. Russia has become like any other European state. There's freedom to travel, and Russians do travel in great numbers. Those who can afford it.
I know that one of the sources for this book was the journals that had been left by many of the major players. Did you get any sense at all that people wrote these accounts with the sense that they would be read later?
Yes. There's one person in particular, Anatoly Chernyev, who was the closest aide to Gorbachev in those days. And he was very insistent to himself that he keep a record of everything that happened every day with a view to Gorbachev's role in history. And of course, most memoirs are self-serving. Most political memoirs are written with an eye on how people will think of the author in future years.
Indeed.
But there are people like Chernyev who had an eye to history and who saw Gorbachev as a very, very important historical figure and recorded everything during those days of turmoil for future historians.
Just on a personal note, I'd love to talk about your preparation before opening the Moscow Bureau for the Irish Times in 1986. This was such a different time then. How did you prepare yourself, not only for what you'd need to know to cover the news there, but for the very different lifestyle you would have to have?
Well, you know, it's hard to believe now, but in 1986, when I went to the Soviet Union, I couldn't telephone my office in Dublin. But of course, we had no email, we had no computers, we had no mobile telephones. I had to book a call to Dublin maybe a day in advance, which isn't very good if you're a newspaper man. I had to send my copy by telex machine, as did everybody else in Moscow in those days, most everybody else. At the beginning of Gorbachev's time, it was very much the old Soviet Union. There was demonstrations weren't allowed. There was nothing appeared in the papers that the Communist Party didn't approve of, which meant there was no real news in the newspapers. The evening television news was dominated by another record harvest every year. That was the top story. So the way I prepared was to learn Russian. Mm-hmm. It very quickly became clear to me that one couldn't really find out what was happening as the Soviet, as the dynamic of the Gorbachev era progressed without learning Russian. And of course, as time went on in those last few years, the action moved to the streets where the large demonstrations were held, which impacted upon the political progress. People who beforehand wouldn't talk to a journalist suddenly wanted their story to be told in the West. So it was a wonderful time to be a journalist.
Journalist and author Conor O'Cleary is former Moscow bureau chief for the Irish Times. His new book is called Moscow, December 25th, 1991, the last day of the Soviet Union. Conor, it's a fascinating account, and I really appreciate you spending this hour with us.
Thank you very much, Chris. I enjoyed it very much.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. If you've got a comment, question, or suggestion, email it to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.